So there have been a lot of cases, and we've discussed a number of them on the show. So you may feel like you've been seeing a lot of instances lately where somebody has come into court and sued over music or a bit of music that they feel is similar to something that they authored that is being performed by distributed by other musicians. And going back to the Blurred Lines case, Alan Thicke and the estate of Marvin Gaye, where the estate of Gaye was successful in that case, it seems like we've seen a lot along those lines. And we've discussed recently, too, the Stairway to Heaven case versus Taurus. So I think, Mike, you wanted to give us some overview about how copyright works in these cases, because it gets kind of complicated.
Sure. It is complicated. I think music copyright is probably the most complicated or intricate area of copyright law, or at least arguably so. So a couple of points that I think will be important as we continue to have the discussion with Joe and Derek is, when it comes to enforcement of copyright in the U.S., in order to enforce your copyright, you have to have a certificate of registration. You have to register that work with the Copyright Office, which is set up in the Library of Congress. And when it comes to music, musical works, we're really talking about two distinct types of works, if you will. There's the sheet music that's written on the page in notation, and it could include lyrics, or maybe it doesn't have lyrics, but that's really a distinct work of authorship in the music copyright world. So we've got that issue. You also have what are referred to in the law as sound recordings, which is the fixation of musical sounds embodied in some sort of device where they can be perceived, you know, on a CD or maybe it's even stored digitally. So the sounds that make up a musical work, that's a distinct musical work that's protected under copyright. So that's going to come into play probably in our discussion when we talk about certainly the Stairway case and probably the Blurred Lines case as well. Another important concept when it comes to music copyright protection is, even once you have a certificate of registration, meaning that you've protected your piece of sheet music or you've protected your sound recording, copyright protection doesn't extend to that entire work necessarily. If you've incorporated typical stock types of musical phrases, those would not be protected by copyright. It's called sans affaire. We've talked about that before a little bit. But typical musical compositional techniques aren't protected by copyright or wouldn't be part of the copyright protection for that particular musical work at issue. And also, if there's unoriginal pieces, if you've incorporated somebody else's musical work or other work into your composition, that obviously wouldn't be protected either. And then ultimately, the legal question here that judges and juries are called to decide is whether the two works are substantially similar, whether the alleged copyist has taken protectable elements from the plaintiff's work. So with that framework, I think that's going to help give a little bit more context to our discussion today.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Joe, as Mike was just hitting those points, it occurs to me that a lot of this analysis is purely the province of the lawyers and not the province of the creators. That as you're writing a piece of music, you're not saying, oh, I'm using a stock musical phrase right now, and so I know that this part of my song is not protectable, or I'm sampling something by someone else. You might know enough as a musician to know I'm going to probably have to clear rights in that. Or you might just forge ahead and say, I like it, and so I'm incorporating it in my work, whether you're flat out sampling it or duplicating it in one way or another in the music that you are writing. Am I correct about that?
Well, certainly that's been borne out in my own academic research. My academic research previously involved quite a lot of deep interviews with creators of music, and particularly collaborative songwriters, essentially asking the question about the psychology of the creative process. You know, how do you make works, how it, what happens when you go into a room and then 3 hours later there is a song that didn't exist before, and what are the specific processes you go through in order to make that, in this case, musical work. But in terms of reuse of material, as a music teacher and as a teacher of popular music and songwriting, this is a question that has been, that my students have asked me throughout my career, which is, how much can I copy? And according to the law, how much can I copy? That is, how many seconds sampling, which obviously is, as Mike summarized excellently there, is copying of the sound recording. And to, simplified in musical terms, how many notes of the melody am I allowed to take? Now, as you guys know, the answer is always substantial similarity, and substantial is an adjective that is applied on a literally case-by-case basis. So whenever my students ask me how much can I sample in my work, I say, I think it's fair to say, even as a foreigner, I can say I agree with the Sixth Circuit, which is none at all. If you take any work from any prior sound recording, and however much you manipulate it, however much you reappropriate it, and in terms of balance, however much new creative content you add in your new derivative work, does not affect the extent of substantiality. So the challenge really, although there's so many challenges, as Mike said, but I think one of the main ones is the way the creative process has changed over the last 30 years or so for songwriters, and certainly changed very significantly since the 70s. And the Blurred Lines case was a good example of this, because the certificate of registration with the Copyright Office, in that case, as we know, registered the sheet music. And in creative terms, songwriters very often don't use sheet music. They're not traditional classical composers in that way. They often compose straight to tape or straight to computer, as it is now, which means that while creating a musical work, in many cases, they're also simultaneously creating a sound recording. And from the creator's perspective, the musical and creative gestures that you might undertake are very difficult to pull apart. So when we, for example, the transcription that was filed with the Copyright Office for Blurred Lines, which I think that must have been filed sometime around the release of the record, which is 77, that wasn't done by Marvin Gaye, nor was it, this is a transcription of the song Got to Give It Up, was the song ever written in that way in the first place. You can hear just from the recording that this is clearly a bunch of musicians jamming in the studio with a sort of melodic framework that the singer has established. So my understanding is that, and disclosure, I wasn't involved in the Blurred Lines case, so I can talk freely about it. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the judge did not allow the sound recordings to be played in court, and instead relied purely on the musicologists' interpretations and presumably performances of those works. But the challenge is, where does a musical work end and a sound recording begin? It's really easy to define what a sound recording is. It's either a physical artifact, such as a CD, or it's a digital audio file. And of course, all the CD is one great big digital audio file on a plastic medium. But the sound recording itself is really quite easy to detect copying. You know, when I'm called on to consultative cases where there's an accusation of sampling, I've got a whole bunch of technical tools that make it really fairly straightforward to detect the sample in the defendant's work if it's there. But and I don't know if I'm using the word loophole technically correctly in a legal sense here, but I certainly perceive it as a loophole, is that what happens when you imitate, using humans and studio techniques, when you imitate the properties of a sound recording but don't copy the composition? Now, this is the bread and butter of the TV ad music industry. The story goes something like this. The ad agency pitches to their client, let's say it's a car manufacturer, and they say, we want, I don't know, let's choose a track at random. We want the Beach Boys' Good Vibrations under this car ad. And they contact the ad agency, puts it under there. The client falls in love with the initial rushes of the video of the ad, and says, "Great, let's go ahead." The ad agency contacts the record label that owns the sound recording of Good Vibrations, and tries to license it. Also contacts the publisher so that they can license the musical work, and either one or other of them says no. Or the cost of licensing that track is prohibitively expensive for the client. So the ad agency goes to a music sound-alike company and says, we want something that feels a little bit like Good Vibrations, and we want it to go under our car ad. And the music company goes, right. And what they do is they sail through the pillars of copyright. Can you sail through a pillar? they navigate the constraints of copyright. So, and I've done a few sound-alike things like this myself, and I know a lot of people who have, a lot of musicians who have. The brief is always the same. Make it sound like the reference track. Don't copy any notes, because that's very much how a lot of case law defines the musical work. But copy whatever production values and vocal stylings or whatever that you like. So you end up with a track that sounds a bit like the Beach Boys and not quite like Good Vibrations, a sort of a pastiche work. So what really are you imitating when you make that new musical work? It's certainly a derivative work, but you're not copying the musical work in terms of the notes, the lyrics, and the underlying chords. But you're copying all of the production values, the reverb times, the equalization on the drum sound, the whatever it is, retro vibe of the production. And if you're doing that, in legal terms, the question, I think, is what really are you copying? You're definitely copying something from one specific work, but you are arguably copying something that is not itself protected by copyright. Like, you know, a production value, the use of a particular instrument.